Welcome to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us and our upcoming annual conference to be held March 13th to 15th, 2025 in Harrisonburg, Virginia, visit ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Christopher Annadale, and this is another episode focused on the theme of place. On this episode of The Sower, our place is Lexington, Kentucky. And here to share Lexington with us is Alan Cornett. He is the host of the Cultural Debris podcast and co-founder of Cultural Debris Excursions. He is a former assistant to Russell Kirk and spoke at the 2022 Ciceronian Society Conference on artist and typographer Victor Hammer. Alan's family has lived in Kentucky since the 18th century. Alan, welcome to The Sower.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What is it like to live in a place where you have roots that go back three centuries? That's not something that very many of us can say, is it?
No, especially for Americans, I think that's a fairly unique thing. It's interesting. I was able to visit the homestead / I guess plantation of one of my ancestors that was built in the 1700s recently. It's still owned by distant relatives of mine who I had never met before. So that was very interesting. He was the second governor of Kentucky, and his son moved to eastern Kentucky, the county where I was raised and where my family, well, my parents still live and my family's lived for a long, long time. So it really is an unusual thing. And it's a pleasant connection to have. I feel a great affection for Kentucky and all things Kentucky.
From having gone to school in Kentucky for a short time, I do know to ask any Kentuckian, what county are you from?
That's right. That's the right question. I am from Clay County, which is in southeastern Kentucky in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And Clay County is, it was featured actually in the New York Times a few years ago. They did a big feature on Appalachia, and the New York Times described Clay County as the hardest place to live in America, which that may or may not be true. It wasn't true for me. My parents were educators. My father was an elementary school principal, and my mother was a teacher. And so I led a very sort of middle class existence. Of course, in that setting, in Appalachia, so there was certainly poverty, but I would say there's also poverty in a lot of places, but there's great beauty and a lot of, a lot of connection to that place and to those people. And I remember when I was young, I could look out, and of course, keep in mind, it's kind of hilly there, but nonetheless, I could look out from our front porch, and everything that I could see, all the land that I could see from my front porch was either owned by my father or a relative of mine, somebody that I had a kinship bond to. That's no longer the case, but it was at that time. And, that's, to me, that was normal and natural. I recognize that that's not normal and natural for most people. But there are a lot of things that I didn't experience because I lived I was in a very rural area. Our county seat of Manchester was around 2,000 people, and we lived 10 miles from there. So, a lot of the sort of access that most people had to shops and stores and entertainment, we didn't have. Just it wasn't there. You had to go to it. I mean, if I wanted to go see a movie, I had to drive 45 minutes away to see a movie. So that was a very it was a unique way to grow up, at least in the latter part of the 20th century, I guess. In former times, it probably was really actually very normal. And maybe we're not the normal ones, but you did ask the right question. What county are you from is always what Kentuckians ask one another.
I learned that from a friend many, many decades ago, a Kentuckian friend. One of the things that might be said, I guess, about Appalachia is that in some ways it's really not, how do I put this, not economically the master of its own fate. It seems to be a place that if not left behind, at least is subject to forces that don't really strengthen a sense, economically strengthen a sense of local attachment, so that looked at through the light of commerce, attachment to place looks like something sentimental or emotional or nostalgic. What are your thoughts about that? Is there a sort of tension here between the sort of localist attachment and the commercial life, the life of business and economic activity, including even simply things as simple as wanting to go to the movies?
Yeah, it's Appalachia has struggled. It has been, I guess, the focus of what is often termed an extractive economy, right? People coming in from the outside, and literally in the case of southeastern Kentucky and eastern Kentucky, extracting coal specifically. When I was growing up, my parents were educators, so we weren't bound to this directly, but the primary drivers of the economy were coal mining and tobacco farming. Now, tobacco farming was something that was sort of all around you. And I did grow up on a farm and tobacco was grown there, but we had alternative sources of income. Coal and tobacco farming are not growth industries these days. And so that even the extractive economy has sort of fallen by the wayside for a lot of people in eastern Kentucky. And there's no easy solution. I mean, I wish I had one. People have been trying to figure that out for a long time. And you know, the in eastern Kentucky and a lot of rural places in the United States on the whole, we've had an emptying out of small towns. I mean, that's not unique to Appalachia. Certainly, you can go throughout the Midwest and find abandoned small towns or downtowns that are drifting away into emptiness. And it's difficult to see an easy solution. Obviously, offshoring of production of manufacturing and so forth has led to a lot of that. Eastern Kentucky was never a manufacturing center. It was mostly based around agriculture and then later coal mining. Interestingly, my ancestors who moved to Eastern Kentucky, the son of the governor, who was named Daniel Garrod, that was the son who moved there. James Garrod was the governor. He moved to Eastern Kentucky and established a salt works. And that was a real economic driver in that part of Kentucky for some years, some decades. It really kind of came to an end, I guess, around the time of the Civil War. The salt works that members of my family owned were destroyed during the war, and I don't think ever really recovered. So they were actually quite wealthy from doing that. Sadly, that wealth did not filter its way down the generations to us, but such is the case. But at that time, something like salt production, it's not extractive in a negative way. You're bringing out a needed resource, and it was owned and operated by the people who lived there, and so you're creating wealth that was staying home. A lot of the problems, of course, with coal is that outside interests have very often been behind that, and money's gone outside. Local laborers have been treated poorly, and of course, there's also with strip mining, especially, there's a lot of environmental and ecological damage that's really irreversible. Once you strip a mountainside down, it's you know you can you can cover up the scars a little bit, but it's never the same. It's not going to be, because you've literally removed part of the land. It's gone. So you have generations now, probably, especially since World War II, you've had generations of kind of the best and the brightest who've left, and you have the brain drain that's affected a lot of locales. And I can't throw stones at that, because I've not lived in Clay County for some decades, even though it's the place that I still feel tied to. But I now live in the bluegrass. So you ask the question, what county are you from? A Kentuckian would always differentiate the county they're from the county they live in, right? So I live in Fayette County in Lexington, and have for some years, and I have not lived in Clay County for over 30 years. But if somebody asked me, what county are you from? My answer would always be Clay County. I live in Fayette County, or I live in Lexington, but I'm from Clay County. And every Kentuckian would understand that and would make that distinction. And so there's very much a tie to the native place where you are from versus the place where you might happen to live.
I do remember my friend back in the day also indicating that just about every Kentuckian would know, at least for their region of Kentucky, which counties were wet and which were dry. I know that's a very 20th century phenomenon. Is that still the case?
That is certainly the case, although a lot more of them are wet, or at least the county seats are, than they were when I was growing up. I grew up in a dry county, and the surrounding counties were also dry. You had to drive, I think, to Richmond in order to find a place. So it was an hour away at least before you could find the legal sale of alcoholic beverages. It's my understanding that there were perhaps some resellers of maybe we might say unlicensed that people could find, but legal sales, yes, were very restricted, and there are still fully dry counties in Kentucky, which again in the 21st century is hard for us to fathom, but that's a holdover from 100 years ago and Prohibition, which was sort of a disaster in a whole lot of ways. But we're American alcohol distribution will always be affected by it for as long as the United States exists. I don't think that there's any chance to escape some of the things that came out of that, and the dry counties are one of those.
It is interesting to me how deeply something like that, which is just 100 years old in a state which has existed for a good deal longer than that, how deeply that's written into the local sense of identity, even now, long after Prohibition's been repealed.
It is especially interesting for Kentucky, of course, because Kentucky is where 95% of all bourbon is made. And so there are a lot of places, where and more bourbon is made in central Kentucky than eastern Kentucky. Eastern Kentucky was not really a bourbon area. It was a moonshine area to some degree, but not a bourbon area. But a lot of places in Kentucky were dry. Some still are, but I think that's something that is fading. You're going to see fewer and fewer places that at least the county seats aren't going to go wet, or at least have sales by the poor, that sort of thing. Kentucky has really been transformed over the past 15 to 20 years by bourbon tourism. And that's really, especially again, that's very true in central Kentucky, sort of the traditional triangle between here and Louisville and Cincinnati. But going out towards Bardstown, of course, and sort of, I guess we'll say west central Kentucky. But there's been a real push to follow what is in effect the Napa Valley playbook there, and where you have beautiful distilleries that people can come to and tour, and they can have tastings, and they have nice restaurants and that sort of thing, right? And so it has brought a lot of money into Kentucky, not just bourbon sales, which of course bourbon has been very hot for the past 20 years or so, especially the past decade, but bourbon tourism is something that's really blossomed in the past decade and is only growing and will continue to grow. So lots of people travel to Kentucky for the Bourbon Trail. And Lexington, where I live, is very much a part of that. Of course, here, very different from Appalachia, Lexington is dominated by, of course, the University of Kentucky, but also the horse industry and the bourbon industry. And those in Lexington, where I live, and of course, I went to the University of Kentucky. I left Clay County and went to UK as an undergrad, and have lived in and around Lexington most of my life since then. I was out of state for about a decade, but otherwise, I've been in and around Lexington. But this area is dominated by the university, which is the largest employer in Fayette County in Lexington. But then also the horse industry, which the Keeneland Racetrack is kind of the flagship institution of that. But there are horse farms, of course, surrounding Lexington, and thoroughbred farms particularly. And then also the bourbon industry has a huge and growing impact on this area.
Is there a particular way it is to be from Lexington? Is there a strong sense of local or at least regional identity? Perhaps not the same as the more impoverished areas where really identity is something that goes way back. What do you think of that?
I think so. I think very definitely so. Now, I have a strong identity with Lexington. I guess going back even to when I was growing up, Lexington was what I guess we'll say was our metropolis. That's where, when my mom wanted to shop, we would go to Lexington. Now, that was about a 2-hour drive, but we would go to Lexington, and we would back then go to the shopping malls because that's where the shopping was. Mm-hmm. You know, two of the malls that people went to back then no longer exist. They've been razed to the ground, but that was the city that I was always associated with. And in fact, I was actually born in Lexington. My mother came here so that she could go to the hospital, Central Baptist Hospital at the time. Now it's just Baptist Hospital, but it's Central Baptist Hospital is what everybody knows it as. And in fact, I now live less than a mile, really about 2.5 blocks from Central Baptist Hospital where I was born.
That's amazing.
I was born in Central Baptist Hospital, but I was not raised in Lexington at all. I was, you know, put in a car and driven home, and then I grew up in Clay County. That's where my parents lived. And I was just, they had the hospital here. But Lexington is, of course, along those lines, is and has been a medical draw for Central and Eastern Kentucky, because there is a strong hospital presence here that that has brought in people particularly who are particularly ill that local hospitals couldn't deal with and so forth. But Lexington as a city has very much a local identity. Now, you're right in that it's more diluted than the smaller, less populous counties, because the university brings in outsiders. But if you can also tell pretty quickly Lexington natives, they're people who, and they know one another, people who went to Lexington high schools. And in dealing with those people, I mean, there are lots of Eastern Kentuckians here. There are lots of people, of course, a lot of international people too, but a lot of people who've come from out in the counties to Lexington. But there is a sense in which you are a little bit of an outsider if you weren't a Lexington high school graduate, right? So that's just that first and second generation distinction. Now, all of my daughters are graduates of Lafayette High School here in Lexington, so they will always have a local pedigree that I do not have. But of course, there's certainly also a very on the high end, a moneyed presence, especially through the horse industry, because you have people associated with horse farms and so forth. Now, there are a lot of outsiders there too. People who've made fortunes and come in and buy a horse farm, because these days that's about the only way you can afford one is to have made money in something and then come in and buy one. And you become a bit of a patrician, in that way. But Lexington, is of course not nearly as big as Louisville, and has a lot of small town features, even though it's a bigger city, especially for Kentucky. It's the second largest city, but there's still very much a local feel to it that even Louisville doesn't have to the same degree, even though Louisville still does maintain a lot of that too, I think.
I think I've heard Louisville described as more of a Midwestern city, and Lexington perhaps not.
I certainly don't think Lexington is a Midwestern city. Lexington is, I think, very much a Southern type city. Louisville is more Midwestern, although Louisville is also home to the bourbon industry and has Churchill Downs and the Kentucky Derby. So, but as a river town, there's a connection there with something like Cincinnati. It's interesting. Years ago, I was talking to my old boss, Russell Kirk, about Cincinnati. And he mentioned having traveled to Cincinnati in his younger days. And I said, yes. I said, Cincinnati's really very much a Midwestern city. And he said, oh, really? He said, that's interesting, because I thought when I got there that it seemed very Southern to me. And so that's somebody coming from Michigan versus somebody coming from the other direction. So
that is funny.
I think now probably most people would see Cincinnati as quite Midwestern, but then maybe not. Maybe somebody coming from another place wouldn't see it quite that way. But I think a lot of people coming to Louisville from the north would see Louisville as being quite Southern. But if you're coming to it from Mississippi, you probably wouldn't see it that way. So the South is not a monolith, of course, and it is on the frontier. I am always insistent that God put the Ohio River there for a reason, and that's to delineate the line between North and South in the U.S. So, but obviously Louisville does have unique features, being a river city and being the largest city in Kentucky. It's unique in that way.
I was just thinking that perhaps horses and bourbon, and maybe that sort of third sort of thing that comes to mind when you think of Kentucky, bluegrass, are all connected to the soil in a kind of unique way, where those being the particular things that are quite big in Kentucky does seem inevitable that there will be a certain kind of local culture connected to those the way it might not be if they were something else.
Yeah, Kentucky's is ultimately an agricultural state. So you look at tobacco, which of course was dominant, much more so in central Kentucky or around Lexington than it was in eastern Kentucky. You get much further in eastern Kentucky than where I lived, and tobacco really wasn't grown. It just wasn't, there wasn't the ability to do it in the same way. But in and around Lexington, a lot of burley tobacco was grown. And you'll still see some if you drive out in the rural areas a little bit. But horse farming is obviously, it's an agricultural activity. You have a farm with livestock. It's a livestock operation. And then bourbon is, bourbon developed because of corn, because it was a way to preserve and monetize frontier corn production when people came out west, and Kentucky was the original frontier. It was the old west. Corn was really the native crop, and if you had too much or a surplus, I guess I'll say not too much, but if you had a surplus, more than you needed to eat and you needed to preserve it, a way that you can preserve it essentially indefinitely is to distill it, is to make corn whiskey. And if you make corn whiskey, then you have something that is easily transportable, will keep. You don't have to worry about it spoiling particularly. I mean, there are ways it can be spoiled, but generally speaking, as long as you take care of it, it won't be. And of course, it was a product a lot of people enjoyed. It was easily sold. It was essentially, shall we say, a liquid asset in that sense that you could easily monetize. And it was a way that farmers could bring in actual specie money, right? They could bring in real cash. So it was the bourbon industry is an outgrowth of local corn production, and a way it was a sophistication of that initial corn production and what was sort of essentially what we would think of as moonshine, but just sort of clear spirits. And then they discovered that if you put it in a barrel for a while, it tasted better the longer that it was in that barrel. And that was something that developed, at least stories have it, by as a result of shipping it down the Ohio River, down the Mississippi, and then either to New Orleans or even around to New York. So that's how goods would be transported at that time. The Ohio River, of course, is a navigable river, and that feeds directly into the Mississippi, and you have access to the entire world from there. And that was how you would move goods like that. But now Kentucky actually still grows a lot of corn and is also the largest beef producer east of the Mississippi River. So, so it's it has a very active agricultural sector. Now, a lot of that is done in western Kentucky, which is, as people in western Kentucky would say, the part of Kentucky that's often ignored. But western Kentucky is a very active and really vibrant agricultural region, and a lot of crops grown out there. And you get far enough west, and they even grow cotton out there. So cotton is not was never a dominant crop in Kentucky. Corn was, but you get far enough west, and you're kind of in the north end of that delta area, essentially, and you're just north of Memphis, and they do grow, can grow, and do grow cotton out there. But Kentucky, of course, was also famous for ham production. Country hams are Kentucky hams are very famous. And if you look at sort of the area where hams are well thought of, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, that's also a bourbon area because you need the same climate to cure hams that you do to age bourbon. And you want hot summers and cold winters. And so Kentucky and those other areas are very seasonal. And that's why you produce great hams, and you produce great bourbon as well, and whiskeys in those areas. So, I mean, even one hates to mention it, but if you look down to our sister state, Tennessee, to the south, and they do have a place called Jack Daniel's that makes a fair amount of whiskey. And that's also very much in the Tennessee ham area as well. So all of those are overlapping sort of a Venn diagram, I guess, if you will, of a blessed a blessed weather pattern that keeps us. Of course, it doesn't feel like that right now because we're in the mid 90s, so we're suffering from our hot summer right now.
A few moments ago, you mentioned Russell Kirk and your work. You worked with him and had different perspectives as a Michigander and a Kentucky boy on the sort of status of Cincinnati as a border city and a river town. I'm thinking more generally about localism and attachment to place. It's obvious from the way that you talk and the other people on this podcast have talked that there's something very highly particularist about attachment to place. It's attachment to this place, you know, to mm-hmm. Lexington, to Clay County, to Western Kentucky, to Mecosta. Mm-hmm. What are some lessons? Are there lessons or memories that you have from your time with Russell Kirk about the sort of nature and perhaps the limits or the future of localism? It seems like you can't really have a rallying cry, you know, sort of localists of America unite, because each of us is rooted in his particular place and doesn't want to be a universal citizen of nowhere. But the possibilities of collective action seem somewhat limited by that very fact. What do you think?
That is true to a certain degree. Of course, in an ironic way, modern technology can help with some of that. And just as you and I are speaking via Zoom from far away from one another, while we're still in our local place, we can communicate. Dr. Kirk was very much a localist. He identified himself as being from what he called the Michigan Stump Country. You know, and that name came because that area was logged out back in the 19th century, and what remained were the old stumps of the trees they had felled and taken away, and so it was known as the Stump Country. But he loved to tell stories of locals and stories in a lot of ways that mirrored the kind of stories I grew up hearing. You know, his stories, the people had different names. Like he talked about the Van Tassels, of course, of Dutch descent, which there weren't any Dutch in Eastern Kentucky. They were all Scots, Irish, and English, but they were still rural people who lived rural lives and who lived very close to the land. And of course, you go up there and it's all very flat and wonderful agricultural area. And the Amish have moved in to a lot of that area and sort of rehabilitate a lot of those farms. And that's happening to some degree with Mennonites and Amish in Kentucky too. But his family went back into the 19th century in Mecosta, and the home that he moved into that later burned in the mid 70s on Ash Wednesday, it was his ancestral home that he had inherited. Now, he himself was raised in Detroit, but he would spend his summers in Mecosta with his aunts and uncles. And then when he left Michigan State to become an independent man of letters, and he was still a bachelor at that time, he moved back to Mecosta, and he could live very cheaply there. It was, and he would sleep in the upstairs of the library because back then Dr. Kirk kept very bachelor hours. He was a night owl, so he would work all night and then sleep all day, and you could get away with that sort of thing at that time. But he kept that sort of night owl tendency throughout his life. But Dr. Kirk had a great affection for Mecosta, and his family still does. Of course, the Kirk Center is still there in Mecosta, and I actually interviewed Annette Kirk, his widow, for my podcast Cultural Debris a couple of years ago, and we talked about that connection to Mecosta. And she was from Long Island, but she has very much embraced Mecosta, and she worked with the library and you know, just have a connection in so many ways. And she has brought, because of the work of Russell Kirk and Annette now for the past 30 years, they've brought so many, just hundreds and thousands of people from all around the U.S. and really around the world to Mecosta, Michigan. I mean, think of all the people who've gone to Mecosta, Michigan, which is a very small town. It's one of those, you know, literally one stoplight towns. If you blink, you'll miss it kind of places in the middle of nowhere, Michigan. But they've brought so many people to that place, that local place, and who have experienced it. And Mecosta has a very particular feel to it when you're there. It's very different than being in Lexington, Kentucky, or Manchester, Kentucky, or anywhere in Kentucky for that matter. But it is a genuinely local place with its own stories and its own people, and the people there have real affection. And the Kirks' daughters have done a lot themselves in helping to revitalize the town. Their daughter Felicia and her husband have opened a new sort of summer restaurant where you can get ice cream floats and hamburgers and hot dogs and that sort of thing. It's open seasonally. And I ate there a while back, and it's very good. And so, you know, there are things like that they have maintained that affection and that place as a headquarters, if you will, sort of a family headquarters. Their second daughter, Cecilia, who married Jeff Nelson, who was at ISI for a number of years in the Collegiate Studies Institute, which I know many of the listeners will know. They recently moved back to take over the Kirk Center. Felicia's come back to work there, at least seasonally at the shop. Andrea, my friend and colleague, Tom Ruby, and I were in Italy and Rome, recently for a cultural degree excursion. And we happened to see their youngest daughter, Andrea. She and her husband lease a villa in Rome where American students will often stay. And Annette was visiting. And so we got to see them in Rome and had a little bit of Mecosta there. And then Andrea has traveled back for the summer to live and stay with her children in a lake house outside of Mecosta. So that is their place, and that attachment goes back, you know, over a century, century and a half at least, in that place. And so I think that there is a consciousness of locality that people of probably the people who listen to this podcast have a sympathy with. And I'll also throw in, of course, my fellow Kentuckian Wendell Berry, who has done a lot to raise awareness, I guess we'll say, of the value of localism and locality. And Wendell Berry went off to New York to teach at NYU and decided that wasn't his place, right? So he left and he came back and he bought a farm overlooking the Kentucky River, very close to where he himself grew up in Henry County, Kentucky. So, and he has become, I think, one of the most important writers in the U.S. from that location. And he has done so by focusing on localism and seeing the issues of the U.S. and the world through that lens. And he would not be able to say or express the things that he has said and expressed without that local lens that he has. So localism is very important.
That's fantastic. That's a great set of recollections and insights, I think, for us to wrap up with today on this episode. My guest today on this episode of The Sower has been Alan Cornett. We've been talking about Lexington, Kentucky, about Kentucky generally and Appalachia, about Russell Kirk and localism. Thank you so much, Alan, for being on The Sower today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Sower, please share it with a friend and rate us 5 stars. Go to our website, ciceroniansociety.org, for more information about our activities and mission.